Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. Where were you when you first heard about high-frequency trading? Maybe it was after the so-called flash crash of 2013, or maybe you read Michael Lewis's book, Flash Boys, earlier this year. Well, New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman has had his eye on the practice for a while, and last week filed a civil lawsuit against the British bank giant Barclays that alleges it engaged in fraudulent activity related to so-called dark pools, that is, trading venues in which buy and sell orders aren't reported to the public. Barclays allegedly let high-frequency traders gain an advantage in these areas, even while it was telling other investors it was protecting them from super-fast traders. The Attorney General is back with us now to talk about the case and whether it will lead to real reforms in the way banks move money at lightning speed. We'll also touch a few other items on his docket. Attorney General Schneiderman, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be here.
Can you start by explaining what a dark pool is and how banks like Barclays use them?
Sure. There are public exchanges in the United States, and we have a requirement through an SEC rule that all our exchanges be linked. And a phenomenon that started up in the last decade or so was the creation of what are called dark pools, which are trading venues sponsored by a big financial institution that are not public exchanges. But the reason for going into a dark pool is, if I'm a big institutional investor, I want to buy 10 million shares of Facebook. If I go into the regular public market, it's posted, and the price can start to move up as people see that we're trying to buy up a lot of it. The dark pool lets your order sit there. Someone else who wants to sell that many shares can show up, and it doesn't get published. The problem is dark pools, as you could see, are dark. You can't see what other transactions are going on. You can't see what other traders are doing. So you depend on the representation of the bank that's sponsoring the dark pool, that it's being done in a certain way, and they report on trading activity and guarantee safety. In this case, we found that Barclays was grossly misrepresenting the degree of high-frequency trading in the dark pool of what they defined as predatory, aggressive, or toxic trades, luring in ordinary investors through a whole series of misrepresentations. And essentially, this was a dark pool that Barclays made very, very easily available to high-frequency traders, folks who just come in to get in between a buyer and a seller and add a few cents to the trade. They start every day with no stock. They end every day with no stock. They're just essentially imposing a private tax on all transactions. So Barclays lured people in with promises they'd be protected from these predatory traders. And in fact, we found out they were giving the predatory traders all sorts of information not available to ordinary investors, charging them virtually nothing to trade, really seeking predatory traders in their dark pool while telling the public that they had systems in place to actually throw out predatory traders and that there was a tiny portion of the trading in their dark pool.
So it sounds like the heart of your suit is that Barclays misled other people about the existence and nature of dark pools that the bank was also dealing with. But that doesn't critique dark pools themselves. So do you take a position that the dark pools themselves are legally okay or maybe even serve some function in the markets?
Well, no one has alleged that dark pools are per se illegal. The problem is that they depend on public confidence, the confidence of the investing public, that they can trade there safely. And I think that what this case showed, because the conduct was pretty flamboyant. There was this whole division called the Equities Electronics Trading Division, where it's clear that the top leadership was involved in fraud. They were putting out things at the beginning of 2013 saying, oh, we only have 9% aggressive and predatory trading in our dark pool. It was down to 6% supposedly by the beginning of this year. And we know from what they've told the high-frequency traders and the actual data, it was much higher than that. They also misrepresented a second aspect of this, which is important because this could lead to broader reforms in other dark pools. They were misrepresenting the portion of trades that they took from folks and they were executed in Barclays' own dark pool. They advertised heavily that in this world of linked markets, they will aggressively seek with high technology to find the place where the investor can get the best possible price for their trade. In fact, we know that the overwhelming majority of the trades were sent to Barclays' dark pool itself, whether they should have been or not. And when a couple of directors prepared a presentation for a big institutional investor, which would have revealed that 75% of all trades were executed in Barclays' dark pool as opposed to the 11 public exchanges and dozens of other dark pools,
That's
the top management told them to alter the number and make it 35%.
Nice.
One person quit and the other was fired for refusing to deceive the client.
And Barclays is the same bank that was involved in the LIBOR scandal where it was found to be manipulating interest rates that it charges other banks on various transactions. So is there something rotten at Barclays in particular, or are they just one bank, one basketball arena, and all the banks are engaging in this sort of behavior more or less?
Well, we can't say that. We do know that, and I have to say the Barclays management, since we filed our complaint, has responded that they are going to take whatever steps necessary to fix this and are, in fact, conducting their own internal review, and we'll be talking to them about that as they go forward. I think it raises questions about this whole area of dark pools and the relationship between high-frequency traders and dark pools that are questions that many investors are going to be asking of other banks right now, and we know they are. And we know that some major investors have said they don't want to do business in Barclays' dark pool, and I assure you they're asking questions of all the other banks on the street that operate dark pools to make sure that this situation is not replicated. So I do think this case and an ongoing effort by the SEC to enact reforms in this area is going to change the way dark pools operate. It could be very well be that you see far fewer and that they have to have different measures of transparency than they have right now.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River, New York and New Jersey Public Radio, with New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. Who's actually getting hurt here? Is this just about different high-end firms competing for vast amounts of money, or are there individual investors or pension plans or other types of investors caught up in this as well with harm that, you know, regular listeners might feel?
Oh, sure. The most pension funds and small investors are in big funds like Fidelity or Vanguard and trade through these big funds who were very much a part of this. So it's not just some fat cats investing that got hurt. That we're talking about ordinary people's investments. Small investors very seldom trade for themselves in the market nowadays. They usually have part of a fund that an equities fund that trades stock and they benefit from it. So they were very much the victims of this. And this is the whole area of high frequency trading is now being questioned, and there are a lot of different aspects of it. We have just brought attention to one of the most sort of flamboyant cases of fraud in connection with high-frequency trading, which had to do with the way that people are lured into dark pools and with promises that they have all sorts of. Barclays had something called a liquidity profiling service that was supposed to make sure they knew exactly what trades were going on. They promised to throw overly aggressive traders out of their dark pool. In fact, they never threw one trader out of the dark pool. This is an area that affects every investor every day. High-frequency traders impose essentially a private tax on all trades. They just come into the market, add a few pennies in between buyer and seller, and get out of the market with no stock, start the day with no stock, and go in and tax us all again.
So what's the solution? Are there ways to bring more transparency to the process without undermining the fact that they are, I guess, for a reason, shielded from public scrutiny so they don't move markets before their time? Or I don't still totally understand the legitimate reasons for the existence of dark pools at all.
Well, there was a reason at the time they were created. I know that the SEC and the head of the SEC, Mary Jo White, has spoken out aggressively about this being an overall part of problems with our current market structure. And I think that that's something that the SEC is probably going to act on in its regulatory capacity to try and fix as we go forward. I will tell you that the reaction to our case has been really kind of remarkable, and that we have heard from a lot of big investors about their concerns about this. We were able to bring the case with as many internal emails and documents from Barclays, as we did because of some whistleblowers who came forward. We greatly appreciate their service and their willingness to come forward. And, you know, there are other whistleblowers out there, and I think this is an area of market activity that's going to get a lot more scrutiny over the course of the next months, and I think we're going to see fundamental reforms at the structural level.
Now, you know that whenever we have a conversation like this, basically every time since the fall of 2008, people want to know not if anything is really going to change until there are arrests of high-level bank employees. So can you say with certainty that civil suits are actually going to make a difference toward a fairer banking industry?
Well, I think this suit has already made a difference, and I think Barclays' response indicates that they're not proposing to fight this. They're saying, okay, we get it. We're going to cooperate. We're going to fix this. And I know other banks are reexamining the way they operate their dark pools. We have filed this case. We have not foreclosed any other action. So there are other regulators at work here. I understand the public outcry, and I understand the sense that there really isn't equal justice under law if people who engage in what most people perceive as criminal activity aren't held accountable through the criminal justice system. But I think that in this particular case, while there is still the possibility of criminal matters coming to light down the road or being brought to light down the road, there it is possible to bring a suit that exposes something, that shines a light into this area that no one else has ever exposed before, that really does change the way markets operate. And I would be very surprised if a year from now dark pools were operating the same way and that the kind of conduct that went on in Barclays was possible for banks to engage in. I think that there is going to be fundamental reform after this.
Anything new in your work looking for criminality, if there was criminality, in the financial crisis? Because you came on as real aggressive about that at the beginning of your term. You're doing stuff with the Obama administration about it. But people are still waiting for leaders of the banking industry to go to jail if they did something wrong to help cause the financial crisis.
Well, we still have this joint federal-state working group that I co-chair, and the first case we resolved was the $13 billion settlement with J.P. Morgan Chase, which was the largest settlement in American history. Billion of dollars of that 13 came back to New York State, by the way. And we're proceeding with other cases. The state statute of limitations for New York has already run on criminal matters, but the federal statute is longer, and there still is that possibility. I do hear this all the time from people as I travel around the state, and I do understand and sympathize with, and in some degree share this sense that there still are a lot of folks who got away with something that ordinary people can't get away with. But we are pushing as hard as we can to get the elements of law enforcement that can still bring larger civil and criminal cases to go, and we're having some success. We're certainly getting a lot more done with this working group than was ever going on prior to the time we set it up.
New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman with us for just another few minutes. And let me touch two completely different topics briefly before you go. You know, this is the week that developers are applying for licenses to run up to 4 casino resorts in New York State. And as a precondition to apply, the developers must obtain a letter of support from the local town or city government. Good government groups have pointed out that state ethics laws do not always apply in smaller localities. So do you see opportunities for corruption, because you've been a corruption fighter, in the way this casino selection process is playing out? Are you monitoring that process?
Well, it's an interesting point. When actually, New York state law does require local governments to have ethics rules, to have conflict of interest rules, to have standards. When I took office, we realized that most of these jurisdictions did not have them. So we've been actually working with local governments to draft up ethics rules. My office is not involved directly in the casino selection process or anything to do with that. We are, of course, concerned about law enforcement issues that starting with the approval process, but running into particular law enforcement challenges when you do have large-scale gambling in a community. So we're looking at it from that point of view, but the actual selection process was set up through the constitutional amendment and by the governor and the legislature, and we're not directly involved. But there are rules that govern conduct at the local level, and there have been some scandals about that our office and other prosecutors have been involved with in terms of sales of leases for wind power and other things like that.
And I'm just curious if you, as state attorney general, see any New York implications from yesterday's Supreme Court Hobby Lobby decision that allows companies to refrain from providing contraception coverage to their employees, as was otherwise mandated by the Affordable Care Act, for religious reasons. We've had a few stories in our local news already today. One, we just heard how the ruling may have been broad enough to let companies take other religious exemptions than just these four contraceptives that were in the particular case, because the Supreme Court is letting lower court rulings that were broader as it moved its way up stand. We also had a story this morning about some Orthodox Jewish groups hoping that this sets a precedent for them to get out of other laws. So I wonder if you, I assume you were an opponent of the Hobby Lobby decision, but what implications do you see?
Well, I think it's an extension of a bad set of precedents that go back a long way. I think the notion that a corporation, which is really the issue in this case, it has nothing to do with individuals with religious beliefs. It is a case that extends this to me, completely flawed notion that a corporation should be afforded the same rights as an individual. We as individuals do not get above the line and below the line treatment for tax purposes. Corporations are completely different. And the notion that a corporation has First Amendment rights, that is the law, according to the Supreme Court. I don't think it's good law. And while I'm required to enforce the law, that doesn't mean I can't work to change it. And I think that this is just a bad precedent. The implications are hard to see, just keeping in mind that this was only a case about closely held private corporations. The issue is the application of this exemption for religious beliefs to corporate America. And it really would only apply to some small private, relatively small privately held companies. There are some of them are not that small, but I mean, compared to, this is not a situation where a public company with lots of different investors could ever take advantage of this ruling. But we're looking at different situations in New York. We are certain to see more challenges, and we'll deal with them in time. But I view this as a part of a much more long-term effort to overturn the ridiculous Supreme Court ruling that goes back a long way that corporations are people. I just don't buy it.
New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian.